You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. And it is with great pleasure that I welcome you all today to our event, Policy 2020, Our Nation's Immigrants. A part of Brookings' initiative, Policy 2020, today's webinar complements the launch of a special five-part Brookings Cafeteria podcast series, hosted by Brookings Senior Fellow John Hudak, who will be moderating the event today. The podcast series has taken a deep look into the status and the future of immigration in the United States. Indeed, in the lead up to the upcoming 2020 presidential election, today's event and this podcast series could not be timelier. According to the Pew Research Center, 52% of voters said that immigration was an important issue in this year. And moreover, an estimated 23 million immigrants will be eligible to vote in this year's election. So how and what each presidential candidate thinks of immigration will undoubtedly make an impact this November. To kick off today's event, we're honored to welcome back Mayor Kevin Faulkner of San Diego as today's keynote speaker. Elected into office in 2014, Mayor Faulkner has undoubtedly been a pioneer on the issue of immigration for his city. Recognizing the unique proximity of his city to the U.S. southern border and with our neighbor Mexico, Mayor Faulkner has taken a holistic approach, working not only to improve U.S.-Mexico bilateral relations, but to create job opportunities for the local economy and more. Notably, in 2019, he unveiled his Welcoming San Diego Strategic Plan on Immigrant and Refugee Integration. It's an ambitious five-year plan to make San Diego and the region more welcoming to immigrants and new citizens, creating new roles like the city's first ever immigrant affairs manager. Mayor Faulkner understands the opportunities and the challenges of immigration in the United States. So well done to you, sir. Thank you for this extremely and timely initiative. Before I welcome him to the virtual stage, a brief reminder that we are on the record and we're streaming live today. So please feel free to submit your questions via email to events@brookings.edu. That's events@brookings.edu or on Twitter using #policy2020. So with that, sir, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for your commitment to such a vital issue for the United States and for joining us today. You are indeed welcome.
Thank John, you. Well, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody that's joining us virtually. It's a real pleasure to join you all today for this Nation of Immigrants discussion. First and foremost, I want to thank everyone at Brookings for their work on putting this together, not only this event, but the podcast series that highlights the perspectives of so many on immigration in the United States. And so I know today is focused on immigration, but maybe I could start a little bit about telling you about our region, because I think that may be helpful for some joining us from other parts of the country. San Diego, of course, sits along the busiest land port of entry in the world, with Tijuana just on the other side. And I can tell you that our two cities share so much in common: our air, our environment, and our goal of providing a better life for our families. And although San Diego and Tijuana are two separate cities from separate nations, we truly are one binational mega region, connected by our shared history, our culture, and of course the challenges that we face. And over the past decade, myself and my predecessors and the mayors of Tijuana have really built a relationship that I believe is second to none, because we recognize the importance of having a shared vision, of having clear lines of communication, and working together for a better future for our residents on both sides of the border. In fact, we have a memorandum of understanding between our two cities, a signed commitment to collaborate. We partner on economic development, public safety, cultural exchanges. And we advocate together on behalf of our mega region to federal leaders, both in Washington, D.C., and Mexico City. And I think that we proved that by building bridges is more effective than putting up walls. Over the years, we have accomplished so much. We pushed for projects and staffing to improve our ports of entry, like the innovative cross-border express pedestrian walkway that takes you from the edge of San Diego and drops you into the Tijuana airport. Last year, it served a record 2.8 million passengers, or the $741 million San Ysidro Land Port of Entry expansion project that was just recently completed. Our residents live and work cross-border, so that expansion keeps it moving efficiently for those that really need it the most. And we fostered innovation and economic growth, including the use of drones to get quicker access to medical testing. And we annually lead a group of bipartisan mayors from all along the border region as co-chairs for the U.S. Border Mayors Association. We pushed to modernize trade, of course, agreement, and I'm proud to say that delivered big wins for our region. USMCA trade agreement that was signed this year moved trade into the 21st century for North America, but for San Diego and Tijuana, it ensured that a decades-long environmental crisis would begin to be cleaned up. It allocated $300 million for solutions to fix the sewage sediment and trash that has been flowing into our shared waters. And EPA Administrator Wheeler was just in San Diego last couple weeks ago to announce some immediate fixes that are going to be starting soon. This is a relationship that you can tell I'm proud of, and this is a relationship that delivers results. And during this pandemic, that has never been more true. COVID-19, of course, knows no borders. And we recognized early on that our entire binational mega region needed to be in lockstep with our response. With our interconnectedness, if we didn't, we would run the risk of our healthcare systems being overwhelmed. And one of the things that our city did was to stand up a border unified command group of agencies on the San Diego side of the border that would be in constant communication with the cities and state of Baja California and Mexico. They monitor and track the COVID-19 situation from a border perspective to alert us immediately of any trends that need responding to. I was also proud to help to work to donate 1,000 face shields to Tijuana for the first responders that were made by our City of San Diego 3D printers that we began producing them shortly after the pandemic hit. San Diego's and Tijuana's success really depends on our two cities having strong ties and a relationship that really, I think, can supersede the national political rhetoric. As a Republican mayor of the 8th largest city in the nation, I've always made my policies based on facts. And for the topic at hand today, immigration, of course, I really focus on what we can do at the local level. And what we can do is to implement solutions that help those in our communities that are here and that need resources. In 2018, we launched a community-driven effort to develop a strategic plan for how we welcome and integrate immigrants and refugees into our community. And as John mentioned at the outset, we called it Welcoming San Diego. After extensive discussions, the Welcoming San Diego Steering Committee brought forward a set of recommendations for the city to do just that. And these recommendations cover topic areas ranging from economic opportunity to education, to civic engagement. And I followed up the announcement of the plan by hiring the city's first ever immigrant affairs manager, Rita Fernandez. And Rita's been with our team for about 10 months. And although COVID-19 really has helped change her priorities along with everyone else's here at the city, she's been really an integral in helping us serve immigrant communities during this time. Specifically, she recently created a resource guide for immigrants to access COVID-19 related information and services. And she's worked with community groups to promote the Small Business Relief Fund and other relief efforts. And really continue to do outreach to organizations, nonprofits, and businesses to really assess the types of assistance that our immigrant community needs right now. I will tell you, and those of you that have heard me speak on this topic before know that I feel strongly that immigrants from around the globe help define our city. And in fact, with nearly 800,000 individuals throughout our region, one in four One in four San Diego County residents is an immigrant. They share our culture and our heritage. They create new businesses, and they give back to our community. Our economy, our workforce, and future growth are connected to our ability to welcome new Americans to our region. And we are a major American city that is proud of that fact. And moving forward with Welcoming San Diego initiative, and really, for me, hiring somebody to oversee that work was a no-brainer. So again, to everyone at Brookings, thank you for not just inviting me today, but to those of you that haven't had the chance to visit our border region, I invite you to come to San Diego to see it firsthand. We are proud to be America's finest city, if I may do a little boasting. And I'm proud of our relationship and really our cross-border region for success. And I welcome the opportunity to promote it, to talk about it every chance I get. So thank you. Thanks for everybody joining us. And I'm happy to jump in, John, with any questions.
Great, Mayor Falconer, thank you so much for your comments, as well as your participation in our podcast, Our Nation of Immigrants. Your role in that was absolutely vital. Getting the perspective of border mayors is just so essential to understanding what happens. As you well know, most people don't visit the U.S.-Mexico border in their lifetimes. And it's really difficult, I think, for people to put themselves in the shoes of people who are there every day to understand what that environment is like. Can you talk a little bit about what you started with at the outset? You are the mayor of a city that is on the busiest land border in the world. And what does that border, can you walk us through what that border means to the lives of San Diegans and to residents of Tijuana as well? You noted that it essentially affects all parts of life. Can you go into a little more detail on that?
It really does. And we are interconnected. That's probably the easiest thing that I can say. And again, that is a strength. That's a competitive advantage. I remember when I first was elected, and it was on the news that one of the reporters said, well, the mayor tomorrow is traveling to Tijuana. And I said, no, I'm not traveling to Tijuana. I'm going next door to see my neighbor. That's really how we view it. And, you know, when we talk about the infrastructure that we have put in, how important our economy is intertwined. We are the largest land port of entry in North America. Again, we're proud of that impact. In fact, we'll have about 100,000 folks that'll cross the border each and every day. And so when we talk about our shared economy, that's what we talk about in terms of the mega region. You know, when we're creating good quality jobs on both sides of the border, that's a win. That's why USMCA, I think, was so important for us to get that authorized, to get that across the finish line. You know, just from an economic standpoint, I'll give you one quick example on how interconnected we are. If you take what we're doing in medical device manufacturing on the San Diego side, you put that together with the Tijuana side on medical device manufacturing, you put us together, because we are interconnected, we are the largest region for medical device manufacturing on the planet. That is a competitive, as I said, an advantage. Oftentimes, goods and services will cross several times across the border as they're getting prepared and finished. And so that economic powerhouse, that is a good thing. That really helps us with North American competitiveness. So we've said you don't need to offshore, you can onshore. And so particularly when we look at, again, at why USMCA was so important, a region like San Diego is really poised to take advantage of that. And as I said, we have people that live and work on both sides of the border. That's always defined kind of who we are in San Diego.
You talked a bit about your Welcoming San Diego plan, which, you know, having looked at it, having read through it, having seen how it's unfolded, it's a pretty comprehensive plan for your city, but really it's a plan for two cities to continue that interconnectedness. Can you talk a bit about what you've seen as the successes of Welcoming San Diego? And are there, and as a follow-up to that, are there other mayors, other border mayors, or mayors even in other cities that have flows of immigrants coming to those cities, looking to you for advice, looking to build their own similar plans?
Yeah, the answer to that is yes, and I think logically so. And again, when I look at particularly one of the successes that I couldn't have predicted when we first started it at the beginning of the year and last year was how important it would be in terms of information regarding COVID response. That has been incredibly important in terms of medical information, how to access care, testing. That really ties in with all of the goals from the very beginning of the Welcoming San Diego, which is how do we help with information flow in terms of what's available, services, and not just from the city of San Diego, but you know, financial literacy. How are we working, for example, in the private sector on certification? So certification that an immigrant may have had in their previous country and they here in San Diego, how do we tie that in? That's all about economic opportunity. That's about economic development. The work we do in terms of working with public safety and really helping to bridge that gap between our police officers and our immigrant community. And so I've really tried and we've really tried to look at it holistically. And again, to have that office, to have those resources and the individuals that are involved, I think is incredibly A, important, but B, the results in terms of making sure that we are having trust and trust with our immigrant communities as they are here in the United States. That's what it's all about.
As you know firsthand, rhetoric around immigration policy, particularly at the national level, can get quite heated. And part of that rhetoric oftentimes has misinformation about what that relationship is like, what the situation on the border is like. And part of that sort of flow of information is that border cities are just riddled with crime and with gangs and with problems. Can you talk a bit about whether those stereotypes match the reality that exists in San Diego or other border communities?
Yeah, and I'll tell you on the premise of your question, really as administrations, you know, on the federal level, you will always have those changes and there's always going to be rhetoric on both sides. I've really tried to focus on what is it that we can affect on the ground here as mayor? What can I do to affect next door with the mayor of Tijuana? And how do we do that as border mayors? Again, one of the reasons why we restarted the Border Mayors Association a couple years ago was to talk about that in terms of shared voices and a shared vision. Because a lot of the issues that we deal with here in San Diego and Tijuana are the same as the Texas border and other parts of the Southwest. I will tell you when it comes to public safety, proud that we were, last year, the safest big city in the country. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens, of course, with our men and women that are out there protecting us and wearing the badge day and night. But it also helps, again, back to communication, back to community policing, back to establishing trust. That to me is so incredibly important because when you're able to do that, you're able to have the safest city that all of us want. And so that's something that we're proud of here in San Diego. We work obviously with our neighbors next door in Tijuana on crime issues as well. And back to what I said, I think in part of my opening remarks, I recognized early on that it is important that we collaborate. And yes, there is a border there, but because we have so much interaction, it's important that our police departments collaborate, which we do on a daily, weekly basis, our fire rescue departments in terms of, other aspects of emergencies, but also across culturally. So our arts and cultural department working with Tijuana as well. That I think maybe gives you an example of how integrated we are. And that's a good thing. Again, that's very positive because back to that being the largest land port of entry in the globe, we want to take advantage of that for all of the right reasons. It all starts and ends with communication. And that's something that I've really, really put at the forefront since I've been mayor here.
So you're both an administrator as mayor, but also a politician. And we've actually had a bunch of questions come in that touched on this. It was sort of our listeners, our viewers are sort of looking to learn. And one of the things they're looking to learn is how you deal with political rhetoric when it does get heated. You're a border city, I'm sure, operating in a border city, I'm sure that these political fights can pop up, whether they're within the city or from people outside the city. What lessons have you learned or what tips do you have about how to lower the temperature and have a productive conversation when things do get a bit heated?
No, I appreciate that. And my approach is to be factual, talk about what's really happening on the ground. I can't control federal policies. I can advocate for them. And as I said, we do, both on the U.S. side and Mexico City. Usually once a year, I'm in Mexico City talking about infrastructure investment that are going to help our border regions, just like I'm in Washington, D.C. It's part of a group that we go with our Chamber of Commerce every year. And I do think it's important back to communication. And when I'm in Washington, D.C. or other parts of the country, again, talking about here's what's happening in San Diego. Here's some of the challenges we're facing, whether with some of the environmental stuff that I just mentioned on the Tijuana River Valley. But here's how we're going to solve it. And here's how we're going to work together. And again, if the strength of our region is really that we have a track record of success. And if we're not out sharing that success, nobody else is going to share it for us. And so being vocal about it, and that's why welcoming San Diego, the program and the office that we started with, so important to me and how we set it up, because we did it by what are some of the community feedback and community recommendations that we should be doing as a city. And I think it's, again, this is not a partisan issue from my standpoint. This is what's the right thing that we should be doing. And when you approach it from that terms, I think that the path usually becomes pretty clear.
You had mentioned earlier USMCA and what an important policy that is for your region on both sides of the border, of course, but particularly for your city. Can you talk a little bit about over the next several years, what you'd like to see come about as a result of UMCA? What will be some good benchmarks to show that it's really working for your city and for your region? And after that, as a follow-up, what are the next policy steps? Of course, USMCA isn't going to fix everything. What are some additional policy changes you'd like to see?
Well, I think you're right. It won't fix everything, but it was hugely important. And it's really, first, foremost, second, and third, it's about growing our economy. And again, back to that North American competitiveness on really United States, Mexico, and Canada working together. We know how to do it, particularly as we are competitive, obviously, in a global economy. And so as I think we modernized, the former NAFTA, put in some of the protections, there's intellectual property, just to name a few, and others, that was incredibly important. But I also mentioned earlier the environmental protections, well, I think were equally as important. And again, to have, as I said, we just had Administrator Wheeler out here in San Diego. Again, we on a very bipartisan basis fought for additional funding and dollars that was included as part of USMCA. We've had a real issue for decades in some cross-border pollution in the Tijuana River Valley. Not only were you seeing that investment obviously coming on the U.S. side, but we're really seeing that increased investment on the Mexican side. And so that, I think, is a great example of what we can do to move the needle where people can actually see it when it comes to our water quality and our environment. That really has been leveraged by USMCA. And so I think that combination of growing the economy, protecting our environment, and recognizing that in the trade agreement was, I think, incredibly important. And again, as we have worked on both sides of the border, particularly this last year with COVID-19, I know that cross-border collaboration has been a huge area that has really allowed us to work well together in terms of our COVID numbers that could have gone dramatically the other way. And so we're not out of the woods yet, obviously. But again, that collaboration economically, medically, environmentally, USMCA really helped to cement, I think, that, and that is something we're proud of, something that as we get going, as we have signed it and worked, it's going to be up to all of us, again, not just at the federal level, but at the local level to demonstrate how it works with policies, again, with creating good quality jobs on both sides of the border that benefits all of us when it comes to North American competitiveness.
So one of the benefits of doing webinars, although we would certainly be happier to welcome you in person to Brookings, Mr. Mayor, but it's just not possible right now, but we get a good idea of who's tuning in. And we know that from our RSVPs that there are people watching this from border communities, working in city governments along the border. And certainly, you know, probably people watching who are looking to get jobs in this policy space. What are some recommendations that you have for mayors on the border, city workers on the border, people looking to get into policy on the border, about things to think about that might not necessarily be obvious, that maybe you learned along the way during your mayorship that you think is a good bit of advice?
Oh, great, great question. I appreciate that. I'm going to go back to something I've mentioned once or twice. That is all about communication and collaboration. When you do that, that's how we define success in our region. And again, one of the reasons that I started the Cross Border Mayors Alliance is because we recognized that this border is very vibrant in terms of economically, culturally, environmentally. So vast, you name it, from a policy standpoint, you can get involved, right? And so somebody that's looking to do that, I think we are just, we haven't even reached our full potential when it comes for what this region can do and our region all along the Southwest border. And so to anybody who was looking to get involved in that, I would say you're picking a good time to do that, because if you talk about problem solving, if you talk about bringing, you know, real world policies that have an international flair because of obviously how close our cities are on the border, and cities that are growing, and cities that are, again, on both sides of the border. So when I look at for the next 5 years, for the next 10 years, not only the infrastructure that's going to be happening, but again, how we can demonstrate that our cross-border region can work. And so anybody that's looking to get involved in that, I would say you're picking a good career path, because it's always going to be different. You always have to work with folks to solve problems, but it begins and ends with communication.
We're running a little bit low on time. We've only got a few minutes left, Mr. Mayor. I have one more question for you. It's a presidential election year, as everyone knows, and this year has been a bit sidetracked by a variety of different policy areas that I think were obviously unexpected if we rewound the clock a year ago. But in terms of issues that are important for your city and your region, in the upcoming presidential debates, what would you like to hear both candidates, President Trump and Vice President Biden, talk about that would mean a lot to you, would mean a lot to your city, and would mean a lot to your constituents?
No, I appreciate that. And I think, again, the focus on how we work together and how we demonstrate that collaboration is incredibly important. I mean, I've spent a lot of time on infrastructure and how that works. And really, it's about, I think, you know, first and foremost right now, it's about economic relief and it's about recovery and how we can do that, not only here in the United States, but particularly in our border regions. How do we do that with reopenings that are safe? It's not necessarily going back to normal. It's the new normal. But how do we accomplish that with all of the trade, the infrastructure, you know, rail, airlines, everything that makes your cross-border economy? And it's really not, as I said, even a cross-border economy, because we're linked so much, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. How we do that safely with that emphasis on working together, because that is the future for us to be competitive. We know how to do it. And I think that collaboration will really help define success versus failure in the 5 to 10 years ahead.
And you've served as mayor under now both Democratic and Republican presidents. And so there's a lot to expect regardless of who is elected or reelected in November. And there's a lot that your city is looking for in terms of leadership, right, regardless of who the next president is.
It is. And again, we've had Democrat, Republican administrations. And, you know, it's just incredibly important for us to be able to tell that story. To tell that story of success and how really the border region is interconnected with the middle of our country and all parts on it. Rely on that trade, rely on, you know, how we do it in terms of advocate for needs, for infrastructure, border staffing, et cetera, you name it. That becomes incredibly important no matter whether it's Republican or Democrat, how we're going to move the region forward.
Well, Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for your time today, both for today's panel, but also your participation in the podcast. It means a lot, and best of luck to you and your city moving forward.
I appreciate it. Thank you for letting me share a few minutes to everybody. Thank you to everybody at Brookings, and look forward to coming back.
Thank you. All right, everyone, we are going to transition hopefully seamlessly from our first panel with Mayor Falconer with his keynote and some Q&A to our second panel. I realize now I forgot to introduce myself during the first panel, so I'm going to go ahead and do that now. Talk a little bit about what we're going to be discussing in this next portion, and then introduce my extraordinarily esteemed fellow panelists. As it's obvious by now, we are talking about immigration policy and a new immigration podcast that is five parts. It started with its release today, the first episode today, and an additional episode will be released every day this week. I'm honored to have moderated the podcast. My name is John Hudak. I'm a senior fellow at Brookings and the deputy director of Brookings Center for Effective Public Management. Immigration policy is one of the areas that I do research on, and it was extraordinarily exciting to work on Our Nation of Immigrants, which is a podcast that breaks apart immigration policy, looks at what is working, what is not working, the challenges that exist, and in the end, the hope that there is that we can get policy moving, that we can improve on some of the failures of the past, and really bring an aspect of humanity to our immigration system, which I think for a lot of people, they understand is lacking, regardless of what your political party is, what your ideology is. You can access the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also access it from Brookings website, which is brookings.edu/BCP. And as I said, I'm thrilled to be moderating the both the first panel, but especially the second panel, where we're bringing a series of individuals who also participated in the podcast. We're going to have some Q&A with them. And I encourage all of you also to engage. You can send your questions via email, or you can tweet them at us using the hashtag policy2020. But without further ado, I'll introduce our four panelists today. Danny Bahar is a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. He also serves as an associate at the Harvard Center for International Development. He studies international migration, trade, and globalization, among a variety of other topics. You can find Danny's work on Brookings' website. I really encourage you to do so. It's some extraordinarily groundbreaking work, not just on immigration, but on economic development more generally. Carlos Guevara is Associate Director for Immigration Initiatives at Unidos US, formerly the National Council of La Raza. He leads the organization's immigration policy work, focusing on advancing effective and humane federal immigration policies that uphold and advance family unity, workers' rights, and immigrant integration efforts. From 2014 to 2017, he served in the Office of the Secretary of Homeland Security, working on immigration policy issues. Martin Calau is an author, speaker, and commentator on the human aspect of our nation's current immigration laws and policies. Also, if I can say as an aside, just one of those individuals who you meet and is just a ball of inspiration and energy, despite having some real challenges that she'll talk about today and she talks about in her books, just is the face of optimism, which in 2020, I think we all need a dose of. She's the author of the book, the 2018 book I mentioned called Illegal Among Us, A Stateless Woman's Quest for Citizenship, which profiles her journey as an undocumented and stateless individual facing deportation from the United States. Martine is a graduate of Hamilton College and Syracuse's Maxwell School, where she earned an MPA with a focus on immigration law. And last but not least, Yaneli Llamas is a student at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. She's a graduate of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where I got to know Yaneli. She earned at UNLV degrees in criminal justice and English and minored in the Brookings Public Policy minor, an amazing program through Brookings' partnership with the university. We've had an over 10-year partnership now. I get to meet a lot of amazing young future leaders, including Yaneli and many of her colleagues at UNLV, and I can't brag enough about that program. And we were lucky enough to have Yaneli talk to us about immigration policy and tell her story of her time growing up and becoming a very distinguished individual scholar and woman who's going to be, I think, we're all going to be working for her one day. So I'm going to jump into questions with everyone. First off, thank you everyone for joining me. Thank you for participating in the podcast. I'll have you open for a few, each of you open for a few minutes, but with one question to think about it as you open. Why do you think at this moment it's important to raise the profile of immigration policy and to speak truth about the issues surrounding it? Martine, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be on this panel with everyone, and thank you to Mayor Faulkner for his presence and all the work that he's doing. Yes, to answer your question, as I introduce myself to everyone who's watching and listening, I think it's important because oftentimes the different aspects or different groups within the whole context of immigration is collapsed into one. And oftentimes there are a lot of trade-offs that are made between one group versus another. And so I want to talk about the stateless community because that's one that I represent and my own story very briefly for everyone who who's watching. So, you know, words and phrases like civil unrest, killings, rape, abuse of women and children, those are just words, and those are words and associations that are made about the country that an immigration judge was trying to deport me to, threatened to deport me to. And this country was Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, whether or not all those associations are accurate or not, who knows? But who'd want to find out within the context of being deported there to a country that you hadn't been to since you were a year old? So that was my reality. I did have other options, if you want to call it that, right? The other option was being sent to my birth country that I hadn't seen or been to since I was 4 years old. This was Zambia, the neighboring country of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So certainly I could try to navigate this country that I had no familiarity with and try to navigate the poverty of that country. The other option, the third option, was potentially being sent to a third country. But I don't know many third countries that are raising their hands to take on another person, another immigrant. And the fourth option, which was the most fearful, was being sentenced to a detention facility indefinitely. And why was that? Because I was stateless. So this is the conversation that I really want to focus on. So I ended up being stateless due to unfortunate circumstances. I just had more than some of us do, right? I was born in Zambia. My family is from DR Congo. Came to the United States when I was 4 years old with my mother. And unfortunately, by the time I was 15, I was an orphan. And my role and focus was simply to survive. I wasn't looking for a handout, just like many people who are in my circumstance. I was just looking for a way to survive and navigate in this country and make it. And through all the work and the struggle, I was able to put myself through private school, college, and graduate school. All the while, for those 7 years, I was battling with an ongoing deportation battle. And the possibility that I had were the four that I mentioned, and the main one being sentenced to a detention facility indefinitely. Now, fortunately, some people call it luck, some people call it the randomness of life, but it's certainly not a prescription that I can offer to anyone who's in my circumstance anymore because of the complexities of our current immigration practices and policies. My case was sent to the highest immigration court twice, and the second time it was remanded back to the judge, and I was the Board of Immigration Appeals essentially forced the judge to grant me permanent resident status. So the work that I do now as a result of the randomness and the fortune that I had is, in addition to writing my book, I've started an organization, foundation called Stateless and Dreamers Foundation, SAD. And the work that I do is to provide individuals with resources and opportunities so that they can be able to establish a home in the United States where they belong, right? And so the type of work that I do is essentially providing scholarships, so educational scholarships, the ability to access a mental health counseling, because that's an important and integral part of the journey of being stateless. And the third is being able to access and being able to access and facilitate legal representation. So the right legal representation and being able to tell your story effectively. And so back to your question, John, and just to summarize, this is a category. The stateless community is one that I can say that if being undocumented is like being in prison, being stateless is like being in solitary confinement. It's a group that is invisible even within the immigration conversation. And so that's why it's important that as we talk about, we continue to talk about conversations within immigration, we're looking at all the different categories and all the different individuals that are affected by immigration, one being the stateless community. Thank you.
Thank you, Martine. Danny, do you want to go next?
Sure. Thank you, John, for the panel and for putting together this incredible podcast series that I myself look forward to listening to all of them and to my fellow panelists. Thank you for that great story, Martin. I'm really glad that you were able to share it with us and for all the great job you're doing. I'm an economist, so I think that I think it's important not only to talk about the humane part of immigration, which I think it's obvious, even though we have to keep saying it, that, you know, that the humane thing is to accept refugees. The humane thing is to, help people that are stateless or help people that are even migrating to look for better opportunities, because that's the right thing to do. But on top of that, it's also the smart thing to do. And, you know, countless of studies from many of my colleagues, leading economists in this topic show time and again that all this rhetoric that we hear and that we have been hearing from the White House, particularly in the past couple of years or 3 years, on migration leading to crime and migration taking jobs and migration lower salaries, is just plain wrong. It sounds good, maybe, to some people. It might be catchy for a political speech, but when you look at the facts, the data just doesn't support any of them. And I think that the main message on why, maybe trying to get to your question, John, on why, you know, immigration policy is so important, should be really important for people, maybe particularly even so for the U.S., which is the country with the largest migration share. The largest number of immigrants in the world in an election year, is that we live in a competitive world. And, countries are something maybe we learned during COVID, unfortunately, we are competing for resources. And I think that we do more together than by competing. But at the end of the story, countries, you know, enact policies to compete for capital, right? So they lower taxes so that foreign capital will come in, and they lower tariffs or, you know, spend a whole bunch of time on dealing with trade policy so that goods can and services can be traded across borders. But when it comes to migration, for some reason, it's not obvious. And maybe this is also a self-criticism to us economists that we haven't been able to put out this message clearer, that we're also competing for the best talent in the world. And when I mean talent, I don't mean particularly people who have a lot of credentials and education, but every one of us has a very specific talent, a specific set of talents that are complementary to the talents of other people. And when you look at what this administration is doing, it's exactly the opposite. The administration started by saying that they're not against migration, they're against undocumented migration. But when you start looking at everything they've been doing, month by month, there's always another measure that is stopping migration in general, right? So there's, of course, a very strong policies against undocumented immigrants, a lot of deportations, which also involved a lot of very tough, images, and the way it's done is of course very inhumane. But it also, there are measures against family reunification, right? There has been executive orders banning or cutting green cards for family reunification purposes. There have been policies against immigrants from certain part of the world, or the so-called Muslim ban. There has been very direct policies against refugees. The U.S. right now is at the lowest point of accepting refugees since the Refugee Act was enacted in the 1980s. There's policies against diversity. The diversity lottery has been attacked by the president numerous times. I am, by the way, one of the recipients of the diversity lottery. And diversity has been shown time and again that it plays a significant role in economic growth. And the one thing that one would have never imagined is that there is a direct policy against skilled workers. So there has been an executive order by the president and the White House against the H-1B visas, which are the workers that already have a job in the U.S. or that have an employer that can get them, and they are known to play a huge role in innovation in the U.S., in entrepreneurship in the U.S., right? So we know, for instance, even though migrants are 15% of the U.S. population, they represent 25% of all entrepreneurs. We know that they represent a huge amount of the innovators, more than 40%, if I'm not mistaken, of the patents in the U.S. are being done by immigrants or children of immigrants. So the U.S. seems like it's looking at the handbook of what are the policies to help the U.S. economy in creating jobs, and doing with respect to migration, it's doing exactly the opposite, right? There's recent research by Ben Johns, who is a professor at Northwestern and a non-resident fellow here at Brookings too, showing that immigrants are job creators, not job takers net. So I can talk for hours about all the economic research that we have, and I'm happy to go into detail if there's some questions by the public. But in particular, what we're seeing from this White House is that this rhetoric, unfortunately, didn't only stop in rhetoric. They're really taking a lot of measures to curtail migration, which is even more important in times of COVID, because the recovery of the post-COVID recovery of the U.S. economy, of the world economy, will require, if anything, more immigrants and not less.
Thanks, Danny. Yanelli?
Yes, thanks, John, for having me here. I'm so honored to be speaking alongside such incredible people. And thank you, Danny and Martine, for sharing. I guess to answer your question, why right now is the moment to elevate elevation policy is simply because it's long overdue. I am the daughter of Mexican immigrants, and my parents waited decades before they received their status as legal residents. And like my parents, there are hundreds of thousands of people that have raised families here, that have created businesses here, that have become integral parts of their communities, parts of their churches, and of organizations, volunteering organizations. And these people wait every day to receive that letter that says to them that they can breathe easy, and that they don't have to worry about being taken away from this life that they've built here. In the time of COVID, it's gotten even worse because my parents got their legal residency status in December of last year, right before COVID hit. But all of the complications that have come along with COVID have only extended the process. So like I said, my parents waited decades, and there are people that are still waiting because all of these complications have prolong that process. And it's certainly very scary when you live in that situation, not knowing whether your parents can stay or not. It's especially scary now where the social safety net is not as strong as I think it should be, especially when one considers that immigrants are the ones that are in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of toxic air quality and wildfires, picking our food, they're manning our pharmacies. And they are an integral part of our community. And I feel that a path to citizenship and a path to legal residency has been delayed for far too long.
Thanks, Inelie, for those really insightful words. Carlos?
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. It's great to be here with each of you. And I've already taken so much from the comments to this moment. Look, as the largest Latino civil rights advocacy organization in the nation, Unidos US, who's been around for over 50 years now, and who partners with over 300 affiliate organizations across the country, it's always important to raise the profile of the immigration issue for some of the same reasons and sentiment that you just heard coming out of the emotion in Yaneli's voice. But to answer the question specifically, I think there is something about this moment, which, you know, to name it, arrives as we head into the home stretch of a contentious election. So to me, this centers around two general ideas. Some of them have been touched upon already, but let's go into them. I think that at the time of a historic, maybe once-in-a-lifetime health crisis that we're living through right now, there's some, I'd like to think, some recognition that we are in some way dependent on each other, that we really need each other. And as the warm summer days come to a close and we start seeing some of the reports out of Europe of renewed lockdowns and so forth, I do think that as Americans, we're going to be grappling with these issues again here coming into the fall. And we'll, again, appreciate how interdependent we are as a society, as humanity, frankly. And, you know, our very own research confirms that Latinos and immigrants are farm to fork, overrepresented in the jobs, the industries that are often labeled essential by our very own government. So it's not a stretch to assert, and we do, that many in our communities are powering America forward in these key roles in these key times. Excuse me. And I'll add, our polling is telling us Latino voters are laser focused on this question of how our government, our leaders, will be responding to this issue in the months ahead and into the year ahead. So then a reason to really discuss this issue now, and to your question, John, of why now, is as Congress debates the fiscal policy over the coming days, or who knows, maybe not now, is how do we ensure that we meaningfully account for Latinos and immigrants as part of a comprehensive pandemic recovery package? Because for us, there is no meaningful recovery or the one that we really want unless we include all communities, including immigrant populations. And the second, I would say, is that at some level, there appears, I would submit, kind of a rising recognition that if there is a material change in the policy and political direction of the country come next year, that we are really in a need of a national healing moment on the issue of, on many issues, but certainly on the issue of racial equity. And I would submit that immigration is a big part of that. The immigration policy and political landscape has been the hallmark of the current administration's efforts, one, to get into the White House, but two, carry on with its promises. And in my view, it follows that it should be part of what comes next as we heal from this period of time. And what's interesting is that American voter favorability attitudes towards immigration have actually increased in recent months in 2020. You know, three things I'll just highlight briefly. July Gallup poll found for the first time Americans want more, not less immigration, the highest support for immigration since the 1965. A June poll done by the Global Strategy Group found that the majority of American voters, about 52% in swing states, disapprove of President Trump's job on immigration. And a June Pew poll finds that about 75% of U.S. adults say that they are in favor of granting permanent protection for Dreamers. So let's also remember this key point in terms of the kind of the attitudes that maybe, and we hope might be leading us in the direction of a healing, is that in many ways, immigrants themselves, Latinos and other communities of color and allies have been the tip of the proverbial spear in responding not just to the Trump administration's hard and restrictionist immigration policies, but their root causes. So for many of us following this issue closely, there is a moral imperative to address this issue so critical to many of our families and our communities. There's a lot of attention now, and correctly so, to how our leaders will be responsive to our communities in the months ahead, not just in terms of policy proposals, but also in terms of a willingness to commit to tackling to these issues urgently in the months ahead. Thank you.
Carlos, thanks a lot for that. One of the most exciting parts about doing this podcast was being able to talk a bit more about the human aspect of public policy successes and, of course, public policy failures. It's something we frankly just don't do enough of at Brookings, and this type of platform really allows us to do that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the humane aspects of our policy. I want to start with you, Yanelli. Can you talk a little bit about your journey and your family's journey? You talk about it so eloquently in the podcast, in the first episode that was released today. Especially talk about some of the challenges that your family faced as previously undocumented individuals.
Yes, I'm sure many of you have heard, if you already listened to the podcast, my dad came to the United States when he was about 18 years old. He started off as a farm worker, and he did have a work visa. He would go back and forth between Mexico and the United States to see his family. And that's where he met my mom. And he and my mom started dating. And after a while, he proposed, they got married. But since his life was already here in the States, my mom decided to move with him. Now, she had a visa as well, so she was able to travel back and forth. Maybe 2 years after they were married, I was born in the United States. And again, we were still able to travel back and forth quite frequently because my parents had visas. However, I started kindergarten here and my mom's visa expired. So that was when things got a little bit more complicated. My parents were unable to go back to see their families growing up. So both of my brothers were born and they did not go to Mexico until recently when my parents gained their residency status. So definitely growing up, we always had to be conscious of that. So of course it was a bit painful to see my parents miss out on birthdays and family vacations and all of these experiences that one would wish that they could have, you know. And of course I was able to travel back and forth because I'm a citizen, but I knew that they wished that they could come with me. So when a lot of raids started happening at workplaces, it was definitely something that we had to talk about. I sat my parents down and my brothers down, and I had to give them a talk about how if someone knocks on the door and you don't know them, you don't answer the door. I had to tell them, these are your rights. These are the questions that they might ask you, and these are the things that you will tell them. It was something to be conscious of. And of course, we were very lucky because I grew up in Las Vegas, which is a very diverse city and very welcoming in many ways. But it's still something that's always in the back of your mind, you know, like on road trips, there are certain towns that we don't stop for gas for because I feel unsafe. There have been certain situations in certain places where I'm scared for my parents to speak because though their appearances might draw looks, their accents put a target on their backs. And there was definitely a huge source of relief when my parents did obtain their legal residency status. This was not able to happen until I turned 21 and I was able to petition for them. So my dad waited for this for, you know, over 30 years. My mom waited over 20 years. And even so, it was a very difficult process because my dad had to save up for a lawyer. You know, lawyers can be very costly, especially if you want a good lawyer, it's going to cost you more. I was their official interpreter during their immigration interview. And I can say now that I've been through it, I don't think people realize how difficult the whole process is. As you mentioned before, I majored in criminal justice and English in undergrad, so I should have been uniquely qualified to be their interpreter. And even so, there were multiple times throughout the interview where I had to ask the immigration official to repeat his question, or I had to ask the lawyer for clarification because the questions are very long and very complicated. And again, hiring an interpreter costs hundreds of dollars. So it wasn't until December of last year that they received their legal residency status and they were able to breathe a sigh of relief. Of course, we immediately hopped in the car and were able to spend Christmas with our families for the first time in years. My brothers went to Mexico for the first time and met all of their cousins. But unfortunately, my mom's parents had passed away just months before, both within a month of each other. Which again is very hard because my mom had to go through that without the support of her family back home. And, you know, I think that a lot of this human aspect is what's missing from the conversation surrounding immigration. I've had lots of conversations with people where they say, oh, well, like, why don't people do it the right way? And of course, I tell them that my parents had been waiting for decades and they say that they didn't realize it took that long. You know, both of my parents came with visas, but unfortunately, because of how complicated the system is, that doesn't always translate to an easy path to residency and citizenship. So I guess that's kind of what we've gone through as a family, dealing with my parents being undocumented and me and my brothers being citizens and being born and raised here.
Thanks for that, Yanelli. Martine, I'd like to build on that a little bit. Part of what you do now is work with individuals who are going through the immigration process, some of whom faced the same prospects that you faced, others who are going through it in different ways. How do you communicate with those individuals? What do you tell them about both your experience and the experiences you've learned about? Recognizing, of course, that at all stages of this process, they're victims. They've been victimized in a variety of ways. What's that conversation like?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. And just to kind of piggyback off of what Yanelli talked about, especially in her parents' journey in obtaining their status in the United States, all aspects of that journey, whether you're going through removal proceedings, deportation proceedings in the court, whether you're trying to adjust your status or you're in detention, all of those things are cyclical and they have a domino effect. But the thing, you know, the commonalities that exist around them is that they're systems that are designed for people to fail. It's meant to break you mentally. You know, there's that sort of mental manipulation, that process. And in addition to that, you know, something that Carlos mentioned earlier, there are structural inequalities that are tied to race and ethnicity within this system, right? And so oftentimes people within any aspect of that process often feel helpless, can feel downtrodden. They lose their dignity, right? In that process, you can be the most educated person, but you have someone talking down to you. And you, it really is very demoralizing in that vein. Additionally, it's costly. So that's something that Yanelli said. I just want to emphasize that oftentimes people are hemorrhaging dollars, right? Whether it's through legal representation. I went through six lawyers to find the right one. That took over 7 years, six lawyers. And when I work with individuals, oftentimes when I work with mentees and we're interviewing lawyers, oftentimes they're looking for, even lawyers are who focus on removal cases are often jaded. They're inundated. They're exhausted. And so they're always looking for or trying to find, or some of them are often, they can be exploited. They can often exploit individuals. And oftentimes they're looking for a quick fix. So oftentimes I've heard people say, or some attorneys say, recommend people to just get married, right? So we glamorize this idea of getting married. I heard that throughout my journey. And what's so unfortunate is that many years later, I work with individuals who get the same response, right? And so that's part of it too. So it ends up being psychologically devastating for people. And so what I encourage people to do in the work that I do are a couple. One, it's really about helping people regain their dignity. And one way of helping people regain their dignity is allowing them, validating them, right? And so it's critical that they find the right attorney who can actually validate them and make them feel like a person and allow them to also be their own advocate. So I offer individuals a series of questions and things to look out for as they're identifying an attorney. The other, as you mentioned, victims and victimhood. But I often say that victims also have a voice. And it's really about helping people amplify their voice in this process, right? Because through that loss of dignity, they often feel like their voice has been muted. So we want to amplify their voice, getting them to get comfortable in telling their story, because that's the thing that they have to do over and over and over again. And it's very difficult because oftentimes in these situations, as we've heard, and we heard Yanelli's story, I shared my story, there's a lot of pain and trauma. And there's pain and trauma in having to have to reveal the deepest recesses of your heart and your soul in front of a bunch of strangers, and having them decide whether or not, you know, you qualify, you're eligible, you know, to remain in this country. And so it's really daunting for a lot of people. So what I do is just support them in preparing them in how to tell their stories, when to tell their stories, ways to do that so that it's not so exhaustive all the time, right? And then the last piece is, I think, really important is allyship. Or having some sort of outlet. So that's work I also do. I'm certainly not a therapist. I'm not a counselor by any means. But oftentimes, just being another ear where I can validate a person, they don't have to worry about my minimizing their experience by saying, well, why didn't you just do this? Or something that Yanelli Tai expressed earlier, where people say, well, why is it taking so long? Or why don't you guys just do it this way, the right way, right? So being able to validate someone by saying, I understand, and not having to ask questions, but just listen, I think is a way to empower people. So it's really, really critical for me to empower the people that I work with, especially because they're voiceless, they feel powerless, and they feel like there's no end in sight, right? It's never ending. So at the end of the day, one of the other things that I always say is that I can't offer a prescription. I cannot say if you do this, this, and this, then you will have the same outcome that I have. But what I do offer are ways to sustain yourself, right, throughout this battle that can feel like it's never ending. And so that's the work that I think is critical and important. So again, to highlight, you know, having the right attorney, legal representation, having some sort of mental health counseling or someone to be able to talk to and have an outlet, right? And that can be an ally sometimes, right? And the third is being able to know how to tell your story and control your own narrative so that you don't give that power of your narrative to somebody else and or the media.
Carlos, I want to jump to you next. We've seen a lot of changes in immigration policy since the beginning of the Obama administration, policy changes since that have gone in a variety of different directions at different times. Can you talk a little bit about how these changes generally have affected governance and policy and what types of human effects those changes have had?
Yeah. Well, to help, I think, folks sit with the magnitude of what you're asking, I'm going to submit four kind of ideas or points for folks to think about in terms of how things have changed in the past 4 years. The first is really the sheer volume of policy proposals, executive orders, and the like. The Migration Policy Institute, for example, observes that in nearly 4 years, the Trump administration has issued over 400 executive actions. And I actually think there might be more if you start to incorporate things like operational changes, form changes, fees, and the like. So in terms of what's ahead, you know, tall tasks, if there is in fact a change in direction, an important and necessary one nonetheless, and it's going to require necessary prioritization about what's important. And there's a role there for the human stories to really pop, the advocacy to really pop to help in that prioritization. The second thing I would put forth is that what we've seen in the past 4 years, perhaps more than any other time, is an intentional focus on the tightening of the legal immigration channels. And I know Danny started to talk about this in his opening remarks. Which, by the way, I'll add, includes DACA and TPS holders, two programs, temporary programs that now are on legal limbo and are comprised of folks, some of the most vetted, legally present immigrants in our country, over 1 million or so. But really what we're talking about here in some ways, I shouldn't say really, but what we are also talking about here is a lot of the red tape that's gone up around, frankly, at the end of the day, folks being able to get green cards and naturalized to essentially complete their immigrant journeys, which I know for myself, someone who's completed that journey and naturalized, is a very important capstone to a process that provides permanency and stability in this country. So, you know, we've seen these policies have resulted in demonstrable chilling in the application process. And what it will mean going forward is that there will necessarily be efforts required to engage communities to overcome kind of some of those challenges, those roadblocks, you know, perceived or real, to make sure that folks who are eligible understand what information is out there, an issue that's been talked about here in terms of the quality of information. The third, I would say, is that we've frankly seen, there's no other way for me to put this, a crisis of leadership. This has significant ramifications. There have been five DHS secretaries in the past 3.5 years, the last two of which have been in an acting capacity. In other words, have not been confirmed by the U.S. Senate as required under the process there, for a combined 528, nearly 530 days. And I would submit that the rotating leadership makes accountability, congressional oversight, a challenge, resulting in inconsistent outcomes, not just kind of here in Washington, but in the field. And again, no other way to put this, but breeds a culture of impunity that we're starting to see, or we have seen rather in the past 4 years or so, increase. Concerningly, I think on this point, on this thread, the last thing I'll say is that there is really a question of, I feel like in this you know, crisis of leadership at the department and the agency levels, of how much this, or there's a question, how much of this is subordinated the Department of Homeland Security and its constituents, components to the direction of White House operatives, which is concerning. And, you know, if we accept that there's been a greater consolidation at the White House for these decisions, it's concerning the level of power political operatives have in purely, or should be purely, law enforcement operations. So that's a question that will have to be resolved and, you know, subject to oversight. And then lastly, I would put forward that, you know, fourth, you know, the immigration enforcement spending, I should say, continues to reach all-time highs, dwarfing spending for all other federal law enforcement agencies, excuse me. And to be clear, you know, this funding was already high before the Trump administration took office. And it's also true, I will note, that the Obama administration faced its own challenges, you know, with deportation significantly increasing around 2012. And when it had the moniker place of it on it of the deporter in chief from community groups like Unidos US and others. But what I think the past 4 years have made clear for more folks than in the past is that the essential elements of the so-called grand bargain of what sometimes referred to as comprehensive immigration reform, I think are just plainly out of sync. To put succinctly, while the immigration relief part, I'm talking about green cards, pathways to citizenship so far, of the equation has failed us for many years now. The immigration enforcement side and the restrictions on legal immigration side, which we've seen more and more under the Trump administration, has really seen a boom over many, many years. So, of course, I think that, you know, there's going to be really a need to consider kind of the equation there as the urgent work of finding relief for folks moves forward. And, of course, you know, the urgent human need hasn't abated. And you've heard this here today more than I could possibly hope to articulate. But the ramifications, I'll just note, are significant for many, including an entire generation of American kids living in mixed status homes, nearly to the tune of 6 million, living with an undocumented loved one who we are counting on to be our future contributors, influencers, leaders, you name it, down the line, taxpayers and so forth. So we got to make sure we get this right and really taking heart the human tolls that not getting right for so many years has placed on our communities.
Thanks, Carlos. Danny, you do some of the best work on in terms of the economics of immigration and take on a lot of myths and misinformation head on. One of the issues that you talk about a lot in your research is challenging the notion that immigrants are an economic burden in the United States. And your arguments really, I'm probably over distilling them, but they come down to two issues. One is that for the most part, immigrants are effective economic actors in their own right. And second, those economic actors, those immigrants are also powering an economy that has spillover effects to help everyone throughout that economy. Can you talk a little bit about immigrants as effective, important economic actors in the American system?
Sure, yeah, definitely. You know, when we look at numbers, as I was saying in the beginning, almost any way you measure it, you end up with the same answer, which is that immigrants, if anything, are a force of economic growth in their cities, in their counties, in their states, and for the country as a whole, and of course, for the global economy. And, you know, some of the typical things you hear, if you allow me just, I mean, even beyond numbers, I mean, you see things such as migrants are criminals and then threatening public safety, and there's a lot of economists who have done work on that, and migrants don't assimilate into our culture, and how terrible is all that, and how migrants and refugees take over jobs and lower wages. And I think for each one of these claims, there's really a lot of studies. And I want to maybe just take a couple of minutes to share some data and some facts. So first of all, from you know, just general data and from the work of some great colleagues who are Leah Bustan and Rana Ramitsky. Leah's from Princeton and Rana from Stanford University. They've been actually tracking migration in the U.S. for the past 100 years. And they find actually that the story of the migrants today, it's actually very similar to the story of the migrants 100 years ago. And this goes to this, thinking that some people have that, you know, 100 years ago, migrants were much better and they assimilated better and so on. And migrants today are different. And they have shown time and again that that's quite not the case, that in terms of assimilation, in terms of the American dream. In fact, the migrants actually make it in America in the same way. And if anything, one of the things that actually has changed is that migrants today are what economists call positively selected, quote unquote. It's just a technical name to say they're actually are at the highest deciles of income in their countries of origin on average, right? And this is directly attacks the notion that migrants today are uneducated and all that, because that's quite not the case. And also, I think it speaks to many of my of the panelists were saying that, you know, immigrating to the U.S. is really hard and it costs a lot of money and there's a lot of rules and there's a lot of red tape. So I mean, just by definition, those who are migrating are the ones, I mean, of course, you have the refugees who are escaping, so they don't make the choice. But those who choose to migrate, they have the energies to deal with all this. And you know, on one hand, that's a reality. On the other hand, it's a shame, because actually, I think we could get much more if the borders were, that's my personal opinion, even like less costly to move from place to place. You have a lot of claims out there about migrants committing crime. And what you see in the U.S. is that in the U.S. and in the world, that's not the case. In the U.S., you know, the population of migrants have doubled in the past decades, and crime has consistently gone down. And some of the studies actually find that the best policy to decrease the likelihood, which is already low, that immigrants would commit crime is one policy called give them a job, let them work. And in that sense, I also want to relate to what my other colleagues were saying on the panel, that all this red tape, all these costs, to some extent, they are these self-fulfilling, they create these self-fulfilling prophecies. Because if you actually want to, if you have migrants or any other population, they don't need to be migrants, and you put them a lot of red tape and a lot of burdens, and you actually don't have them to work, and you don't give them the certainty that they're going to stay here for a long time, you know, as any other human being, they will be less likely to invest in themselves, right? If you think they're going to kick you out in a year, you are less likely to invest in a new business or in educating your kids and so on. So all these burdens are actually self-detrimental to the U.S. as a whole and to the society. Some, maybe the biggest myth, and with this I might want to finish, is that because at least that's the official, quote-unquote, basis for a lot of the executive orders we've seen in the past year, and particularly in the past few months, is that migrants are competing with Americans in jobs, and that migrants will take the jobs of Americans, and the migrants will lower wages. And there's absolutely no evidence that that's the case. This debate started a long time ago with many economists studying the Marielle Boatleaf episode in Florida, where Cubans arrived in large numbers to Florida, and there's no evidence that they actually had a negative impact on salaries. There's a big discussion there with some people, you know, a couple of economists finding different results. But in by and large, you find that if anything, the effects are very temporary and very, very small. And, you know, you see this everywhere in the world. There's studies that look at, for instance, the immigration of Russians in the U.S., which was an immigration of 1 million people, which increased the population of Israel by 20%. Right. I mean, there's if you can expect an effect, it's going to be there. Right. And there you don't see any effect on wages. We're doing some work with refugees in Venezuelan refugees in Colombia, and we again find the same results time and again. So there's really no evidence that that, you know, immigrants in America are taking jobs. If anything, the evidence shows that they're giving them jobs. And let me just give you some examples of that. When you actually go, if you want to go right now, to all of us that are listening, to the website of the BLS, which is the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the U.S., and you look at the occupations that are going to grow the most in the next 10 years. I think this captures the idea in particular that migrants bring different skills and can take jobs that are actually complementary to the jobs of the typically natives or U.S.-born in their cities take. Because when you see this list, you will see, yeah, you know, in the next 10 years, there's going to be a lot of jobs for doctors and engineers and software developers, et cetera, et cetera. But you also see that there's a huge growth in employment for personal care aides and home health aides and cooks and taxi drivers, right? And this brings the idea that I think it's fundamental in understanding the economics of this, that a doctor can't do his or her job without the nurse, and without the person who cleans, and without the cook, and without a whole ecosystem of occupations around, out of which many of them are immigrants. And simply put, the U.S. can't survive, being a thriving economy with all the skills and all the occupations that are being in some cases, predominantly filled by immigrants, as we've seen in COVID. In COVID, we've seen that a quarter of the doctors in the U.S., in COVID, we realized that a quarter of the doctors in the U.S. are immigrants, whereas only 15% of immigrants are, the population has only 15% of immigrants. So immigrants are overproportionally being the doctors. Same thing for the nurses. Same thing for many of the occupations that are supporting us during COVID. So I think, just to put it simply, that it's naive to think that the U.S. can thrive in this new era and in general without its migrants. If migrants are a force of growth for the U.S. economy, and there's just no. I think we just have to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, because it's the numbers show it in such an obvious way. And again, I think that our challenge as economists, as people who research policies, to really understand why this message perhaps is not being internalized by many, and I think that's a challenge I take very seriously, and we're going to keep working on that.
So we're unfortunately running a little short on time, but I want to jump into a couple of questions that came in from our viewers. And they sort of crystallize several questions that come in, and I'm going to combine two together. I'll ask you to start, Yanele, but anyone who wants to jump in, to jump in. The first is from Susan Eikenberry from the Georgetown Day School, who asks, what do you think causes the hostility to immigrants on the part of so many? And the follow-up, or the second part of the question, is from Jeremiah Brooks from Virginia State University, who asks, what empathetic response do we need from the public to address these problems?
Thank you for such good questions. I will answer them as best as I can. I think that a lot of the reason that people feel such hostility towards immigrants is because they feel unsure, or they feel, frankly, life has been hard for a lot of people. And I think it's a lot easier to blame someone that looks less like you than to blame your neighbor. And what a lot of people don't realize is that immigrants oftentimes are our neighbors. I think that there's also a lot of misinformation out there. I know that actually Brookings has put out a couple of really good articles on like racialized economics, which is basically just the whole they're taking our jobs, which is not the case. A couple of my other colleagues have spoken to this, how people believe that immigrants are coming and they're taking jobs and they're making life worse for the people that live here. But quite on the contrary, you know, like my dad had obtained his business license a number of years ago, and now there are people working under him. You know, my mom is a very active member of our church community. And then, of course, there's me. I look back and I think at how blessed we've been along the way, that my dad was able to save up for an attorney, and that, you know, my parents weren't deported. The reason that their process was so fast once we did get all of our documents in, because mind you, it still took about 2 more years from the time I was able to petition for them, is that my parents' criminal records are completely clean. They have nothing besides a parking ticket, you know, a traffic ticket. And I think had one of those traffic tickets turned into an arrest warrant, had there been a raid at one of my parents' place of work, then I would not be here. You know, I'm currently a first-year law student attending ASU School of Law on a full-ride scholarship as an O'Connor Honors Fellow. And if my parents had been deported, I would have had to drop out of school. And that's just how it is. And I think that people don't really see the human aspect of that. I think that they find it very easy to dehumanize people that maybe look or act a little bit different than them. And once you dehumanize someone, it becomes much easier to blame your troubles on them, when really we should be working together, you know, as corny as that sounds, in order to build a society that works better for all of us, you know, whether it be the farm workers or the grocery store workers or the lawyers or the doctors. Immigrants are an integral part of our community, not only like the immigrants themselves, but also the families that they built here. As far as, I believe the second question was, how can we bolster more empathy towards immigrants? I would say it's having conversations like this one and definitely fighting against that misinformation. I know Danny mentioned that there are many studies that show that immigrants don't increase crime rates. And there are many studies that actually show the opposite, that immigrants are much less likely to commit crimes, because there's so much at stake. And immigrants don't come here looking for a handout. They come here looking to work. They come here looking to build a better life for themselves and their children. And at the end of the day, that's what we all want.
I don't know if anyone else wants to jump in.
Yeah, I was gonna jump in. Yeah, I think that the reason there's so much hostility towards immigrants is because oftentimes when we watch, look at the media, there are two portrayals of immigrants, are either superhuman or subhuman, right? Neither of which are human. And the majority of us fall within the middle, right? And the reason there's hostility is because most of us cannot identify with that superhuman or the subhuman, right? We can't identify with that group. It's the middle group. It's people like myself that you can identify with. And secondly, you know, how can we be more empathetic? I think seeking stories like ours, the non-superhuman, the non-subhuman, and seek stories that mirror our own personal stories, right? And I think part of empathy, the idea is oftentimes what we find is that, especially within the conversation around immigration, is there's this need, there's this emphasis to try to agree. So I think empathy is less about agreeing and more about understanding. So be empathetic by not trying to agree or disagree with the journey that the person took to be here or the journey they're taking to stay here, but really focus on understanding. So pivoting your lens just a little bit to understand how is it possible, you know, is it possible that I could have been in the same situation if my life had taken a different turn? Could I potentially be like this person? Or how is my life parallel to this person, right? And I think that's one way that we can begin to build that level of empathy.
All right, guys, unfortunately, we're out of time. I could talk to the four of you for hours. I don't know how many people would continue tuning in for hours. But before we wrap, I just want to take a few quick seconds to do some thank yous. The Emmys were last night, so my apologies that this is going to sound a little bit more like an Emmy acceptance speech. But I definitely want to thank our participants today. Mayor Falconer first, John Allen for introducing him. In this panel, Yaneli Llamas, Danny Bahar, Carlos Guevara, and Martin Calau, and everyone else, including you guys, who helped participate in Our Nation of Immigrants, our new podcast that premiered today. In addition, our team here at Brookings, Andrea Risotto, Fred Dews, this really does sound like an Emmy speech, Fred Dews, Gaston Reboredo, Chris McKenna, Christine Stanglin, Paloma Lozada, Sean Dar, and Adriana Pita, who have been absolutely integral in terms of putting together the podcast, the planning for the podcast, the events today, and the promotion of all of it as we move forward. Remember to listen to Our Nation of Immigrants wherever you download your podcasts, or you can find it on the Brookings website at brookings.edu/BCP. And you can continue the conversation about immigration policy and a variety of other areas of policy by using hashtag Policy2020 and visiting Brookings Policy 2020 page, where we have a variety of issues that are important to this election and certainly important to the next administration, whoever the next president might be. So thank you guys for being on the panel today. Thank all of you for watching and participating, and please join us at future Brookings events.